One, two.
This week, we've got jazz singer Diana Krall in the studio singing sweetly for Steve Inskeep. And we've also got a Malaysian singer who was discovered on YouTube.
But first, Judd Apatow was on Fresh Air this week to talk about the development of his new movie, Funny People. The film is about a stand-up comedian played by Adam Sandler who learns he has a terminal illness.
I want you to possibly do me a favor.
Okay, yeah, what?
Kill me.
What?
Nobody knows we know each other. You're a stranger. You can get away with this. I got a gun in the other room. It's untraceable. I'll give you $50,000. Don't make me suffer. Please. Kill me, Ira. I'm begging you.
Can you at least give me like a night to think about it?
Ha! Think about it! You would do it!
Oh, I hate you, man. Oh, no!
Ira, I misread you. You're sick. You're a murderer.
Oh, screw
you. Wanted to do it.
You, man.
What would you have done for $100,000? Chop my head off?
Apatow talked about rooming with Adam Sandler when they were both undiscovered comedians in Los Angeles, and about some video footage he shot when they were roommates that wound up in the movie.
Back then, we were in our early 20s. Adam had been on MTV on the TV show Remote Control. He wasn't successful, but there was a buzz around him that he was somebody who was going to do very well. There was no buzz around me whatsoever. I was emceeing at the Improv. And Adam had so much energy to be funny that he would be very funny with strangers on the street. He would yell out the car window. He would bug everyone on an elevator because nobody knew who he was. And he had no outlet. And one of the ways that he expended this comic energy is he made a lot of prank phone calls for hours and hours. He couldn't have been more amused by it. And it really was funny. And after a while, I started recording them on audio, and then I started videotaping them. Then when I was writing the movie, I thought, well, this is a good way to start the movie because Adam looks so happy in this footage. He just looks young and pure and excited about his life. And then after the prank call in the movie, we cut to him in current times, and his character, the light is just out of his eyes. He's in a giant house and he's rich and famous, and he couldn't look more unhappy.
Funny People is such a kind of Valentine to an ambivalent Valentine in some ways to young comics getting started, as well as being about an older comic who's become hardened and cynical. And, you know, Seth Rogen is one of the young comics, and his character is doing a lot of like fart and masturbation jokes. And at one point, the Adam Sandler character goes up to him and says, "Is your act designed to make sure no girl ever sleeps with you again?"
Yes.
did you ever do that kind of humor? And let's start with that. Did you ever do that kind of humor yourself?
I wasn't filthy. In fact, I got on the HBO Young Comedians special, and it was the first time I got on cable, and I thought I should take advantage of this, and I should curse. But I didn't have any dirty jokes, so I just added the F curse randomly throughout my act. And every once in a while, they show it on Comedy Central, and they're beeping me constantly, and none of the jokes require cursing, and it's very, very embarrassing to me. So no, that wasn't what my subject was about, because in order to have jokes about sex, you would have needed to have had sex. So I did not have the experience to do those jokes.
Were you exposed to a lot of comics who did?
I was exposed to a lot of comics who did. There's definitely a correlation between people who want to perform and people who want to meet the crowd and have sex with them. There's definitely a lot of sexual energy in the comedy clubs. Do not chat with the comedians after the show, people. You'll put yourself in a dangerous situation.
You know, you might think that actors are the only ones who do that, go out and play someone else. But American jazz singer Diana Krall was on Morning Edition this week talking with Steve Inskeep about her new album, Quiet Nights. She says she, too, tries on different characters when she sings different songs.
The singer Diana Krall is touring this summer, and when she tours a lot, she improvises a lot. She demonstrated while playing and talking at the Grand Piano in a Washington hotel.
If you see me walking down the street and I start to cry each time we meet, walk on by.
What? Sorry, I'm struggling with this piano a little bit. Come on, behave.
I'll blame it on the piano. Oh, baby, it's okay. It's just... It's I haven't played this before. Let me just try to get a feel for this one.
Diana Krall became famous interpreting the hits of Frank Sinatra or Ella Fitzgerald, or in this case, Dionne Warwick, which, by the second try, falls into place.
If you see me walking down the street and I start to cry each time we meet, walk on by.
Krall is touring with toddler twins she had with her husband, the musician Elvis Costello. So after making sure the kids had lunch, she came to the presidential suite at Washington's Mandarin Oriental Hotel. Though she was recovering from a cold, one that made us worry about straining her voice, she launched into a stream of thoughts about the songs that she chooses.
And I'm always thinking about a character when I'm playing. I mean, I guess Joni Mitchell's A Case of You is something where it's taken me, 10 years to find my character in that, so that I'm not just paying homage to Joni Mitchell.
I feel like you're telling me almost that you're method acting. You're not planning to play the song differently. You're trying to feel it differently, which may change the way you play it.
Everything I do, especially ballads, like The Boy from Ipanema, Girl from Ipanema. If I had my choice now, I'd sing Girl from Ipanema. But I think that my idea about singing it in Boy from Ipanema was returning to Brazil, this 40-something woman, looking at these beautiful and thinking about her youth. Everybody thinks of I did some press in England recently, and it was introduced as that 60s classic. And it is a 60s classic, but there's something else to it that's deeper than that. And I wanted to get there. I wanted to illustrate that, and I can, especially if I do play it like solo, I think I can... Tall and tan and young and handsome, the boy from Ipanema goes walking, and when he passes each girl he passes goes. When he walks it's like a samba that swings so cool and sways so gentle, and when he passes each girl he passes goes.
You can hear the full interview at our website, npr.org/culturetopia.
Last week, I found out that author E. Lynn Harris died at the age of 54. The time was 2 p.m. I had 2 hours to do his obit. I don't know if you've heard of Harris, but he wrote multiple bestsellers, mostly about African-American men who love other men. His readership was largely African-American women. Here's the piece that I put together. When E. Lynn Harris burst onto the scene, he wrote about something nobody wanted to touch, the down-low. Closeted African-American men, gay men, who are also often in relationships with women. Harris wrote 13 books, 10 of them were New York Times bestsellers. His first, Invisible Life, was about a young black professional who finds himself in a bisexual love triangle. Harris discussed it on NPR earlier this year.
15 years ago, when I wrote Invisible Life, everybody thought I had created something new, when in fact, it's probably been going on since the beginning of time.
Invisible Life was published in 1994. Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor at Essence Magazine, says Harris quit his longtime job as a computer salesman to write it. At first, he couldn't get it published, so he did it himself.
He decided to sell the book at African-American beauty parlors and barbershops and at parties and at sorority events. And the novel struck a chord with African-American women and African-American readers.
It was his breezy sense of humor, melodramatic soap opera plots, and the glamorous, wealthy, gorgeous, conflicted characters. Bass says no one was going to confuse E. Lynn Harris with literature of the highest order, least of all,
Elin Harris.
But what he understood was he knew how to entertain an audience. He knew how to keep their attention. That once you went into an Elin Harris novel, and they weren't for everyone, you know, but once you went into there, it was impossible for him not to sustain one's attention.
Harris says Bass changed the tenor of the Black community's discussion about sexual orientation. He humanized African-American gay men.
And African-American women who love men on the down low, their brothers, their spouses, their sons, their nephews. He was able to bring that out of the closet in a way that was done with complete compassion, complete humanism, and just a complete sense of intelligence.
Elin Harris loved corresponding with fans and supporting young writers. His book readings tended to be parties. Harris said he got the ideas for his characters and books in part from his own experiences, like being the first Black male cheerleader at the University of Arkansas. He took on controversial topics like the relationship between Black churches and gays or the world of closeted professional athletes.
I got so many ideas. I feel so fortunate and so blessed, you know, to be able to do this and to still do it with such excitement. You know, I was writing right before I came in to talk to you today, and this is really, really exciting to wake up in the morning or when in the evening and all times during the day and want to go back to my characters.
Harris told NPR back in March he was working on two new books, a story about three generations of African-American women and a glitzy romance about a man who gets disowned by his wealthy family and starts a modeling agency in Miami. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
I just have to tell you, Linda, that Elin Harris is such an original and fascinating character. It drove me absolutely berserk to only have a couple of hours to do his obit. And there were so many details that I left out, that he'd been a computer salesman at IBM for 13 years and that he'd started fellowships for young writers. He really seems to have been adored by a lot of the people around him. And I think what a lot of people don't know at NPR is that we do some obits in advance. We have a whole shelf of obits, and of course there are ones like Fidel Castro who've been there, you know, for decades, and they get updated regularly. But someone like Elin Harris, it was utterly unexpected, and to have just that little sliver of time to do him justice was really hard.
It is interesting how different that process is, sort of depending on how much warning you have. And I had somebody ask me, I'm sure it was around the time that Michael Jackson and Farrah Fawcett had died, and we had written on the blog about both of them and in much less detail, and obviously without, you know, a lot of what you're able to accomplish in a piece like that. But I had somebody ask me, you know, do you sit around with blog posts prepared about all these people who might potentially die? And it was interesting because in that situation, obviously, they were in very different situations, because it had never occurred to me to write anything about Michael Jackson. But it had occurred to me to write something about Farrah Fawcett, since there were, you know, frequent discussions of the fact that she appeared to be close to the end of her life. And I couldn't bring myself to write it. It was such a strange feeling. And I found that I did put it off until after she had died, simply because, you know, people who haven't done that a lot, they're not as accustomed to it.
We don't have one this week. Bob Mondello, our film critic, is really great at doing these last-minute appreciations. But this week, he's got a review of the British comedy In the Loop. It's a screwball comedy about the days leading up to the Iraq War. Bob says he's never seen a movie that uses curse words in such a smart, inventive way.
See if this sounds familiar. The U.S. is pushing for a war in the Middle East, going for a U.N. resolution, though there's no reliable intelligence to back them up, and the Brits are staying carefully neutral, which is why the Prime Minister's communications director turns purple when he hears Simon Foster, a low-level minister, not staying neutral on a talk show.
I think that war is unforeseeable.
Sam! Sam!
Unforeseeable. Yes.
No, you do not think
yes,
that.
But I think
Sam.
The communications director rushes to Simon's office to tell him that he can make no more public statements until he learns to keep to the government line.
No, I was going to keep to the line. I was going to say, I don't think war is unforeseeable.
What is it then?
I don't know. Foreseeable?
No!
No.
Not foreseeable. That's declaring war. Do you want to declare war? Write this down. It's neither foreseeable nor unforeseeable.
Right. So, not inevitable, but not...
You better work on this line. inevitable.
Meanwhile, on our side of the Atlantic, a State Department official has sniffed out a war committee and is trying to rally administration doves, including a general she spies at a Washington cocktail party. Pulling him away to a child's playroom, she asks him about troop levels, and he picks up the only calculator he sees.
So you add these together.
Yeah.
It's pink and has pictures of bunnies on it.
So this is the number of combat troops available for an invasion according to these figures.
12,000?
12,000 troops, but that's not enough. That's the amount that are going to die. And at the end of a war, you need some soldiers left, really, or else it looks like you've lost.
They decide they should team up with this British guy who talked about war being unforeseeable to help internationalize the dissent, which might work, except that Simon's gotten in front of the press again.
Also
to clarify.
Unforeseeable. For the plane in the fog, the mountain is unforeseeable, but then it is suddenly very real and inevitable.
His press secretary looks terrified.
The mountain in the metaphor is a completely hypothetical mountain that could represent anything. What I'm saying is that to walk the road of peace, sometimes we need to be ready to climb the mountain of conflict. Thank you so
Which,
much.
As his furious boss screams, makes Simon sound like a Nazi Julie Andrews. Director Armando Iannucci co-scripted In the Loop with an eye to making War Fever play as a sort of screwball tragedy. Imagine a mashup of Dr. Strangelove and Wag the Dog, and you've got the general idea. The performances are explosively funny, from Tom Hollander's way-out-of-his-depth Simon to the peacenik general that James Gandolfini gives anger management issues. But the star is Peter Capaldi, doing some of the most ornate, inventive, unplayable on the radio swearing you will ever hear. Truly a boss from hell for the ages.
Simon, I don't like finding out about people employed by this government via the news unless they've just died. Be here now.
The thing that distinguishes In the Loop is that it's so easy to imagine that this really is how governments make earth-shaking decisions. Attack dogs going rabid, folks who actually know something ducking for cover, and low-level screw-ups turning into world-class catastrophes. You laugh and laugh, because the alternative would be to weep for us all. I'm Bob Mandela.
Who's not weeping these days is Malaysian singer Zee Avi. She was discovered about a year and a half ago. A manager at Jack Johnson's record label saw her on YouTube and flew her to Los Angeles. She tells Weekend All Things Considered's Guy Raz that since then, it's been a whirlwind.
Zee, English isn't your first language, right?
Sort of. I've been speaking it my whole life.
English and Malay. And there's a track on your album called Kantoi. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, Kantoi, yeah.
And it's a mixture of Malay and English, which is actually a language that exists, right?
Manglish.
Can you play us some of that song?
Sure. Semalam I call you, you tak answer. You kata you keluar pergi dinner. You kata you keluar dengan kawan you. But when I called Tommy, he said it wasn't true. So I drove my car pergi daman sara. Tommy kata maybe you tengok bola. Tapi bila I sampai you, you tak ada lagi lah. I jadi gila. So I called and called sampai you answer. You kata sorry sayang tadi tak dengar. My phone was on silent, I was at the gym. Tapi latar belakang suara perempuan lain. Sudahlah sayang, I don't believe you've always known that your words were never true. Why am I with you? I pun tak tahu. No wonder lah, my friends pun tak suka you. So I guess that's the end of our story. Akhir kata she accepted his apology. Tapi last kita dapat tahu she was cheating too with her ex-boyfriend's best friend. Tommy.
Tell me about the mix of languages in that song, Malay and English. Do a lot of people understand it?
Yeah, I mean, all Malaysians, and I'm saying all Malaysians, are at least bilingual. I speak four languages myself, and, you know, that song, that version of the song is actually, it's not pure Malay, but it's, you know, a modernized, you know, it's how this generation of, you know, Malaysians speak. And we alternate English and Malay in a sentence. And, you know, the guys told me, yeah, I've heard you do that. And, you know, my bandmates told me, I've heard you on the phone with, you know, your parents or your friends or whatever. And, you know, it sounds kind of like, I kind of understand what you're saying,
right.
But just in, sort of in and out.
yeah, I mean, I understood you talking about your cell phone and a couple other things in there. What's the song about?
It's a funny song. Mm. It's, you know, it's a funny song about, you know, getting caught, because kantoi directly translates into busted.
Uh-huh.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we had today and subscribe to the podcast at npr.org/culturetopia.
I'm Netta Ulabi.
And I'm Linda Holmes, and thanks for listening to Culturetopia.